podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 30 of If This Is a Podcast and What's Christmas. So today's interview is with Danny Kleinman. It's great. He's great. I really enjoy talking to him. We actually made an ad about 15 years ago. I really enjoyed that process, and I thought he did a fantastic job, as he always does. And he was great to talk to. His career spans some of your favorite 80s pop songs to all the title sequences for all the James Bond films for the last 20-25 years. So there's a huge amount of amazing work, as you'll see from the blog post if you haven't seen that already. And thank you, Danny Kleinman. There's a little bit of housekeeping-y stuff. I think it might be good to just mention. I hadn't done a couple of podcasts, a couple of weeks, because there are some screw-ups that I mentioned in a blog post the other week, but then there was some other stuff that it's too boring to go into. So apologies for even starting, but I just thought you'd like to know I get technical difficulties here, a little bit of organizational difficulties. Means I missed a couple of weeks, but I have Danny obviously in the can, who you can listen to now, and you're listening to now. Then I have a very interesting Argentinian chief creative officer, who's chief creative officer of Saatchi & Saatchi New York. I'll be putting him up, I think, next week. And then I spoke to, I don't know if I want to get into who he is in case we never follow up properly on what it was, but I was delighted to have a chat with one of my absolute creative heroes a week or two ago. And true to form, I think this is brilliantly him. Like, we did about an hour and a half of chatting and got, I don't know, about 6 years into his career. And I think there's probably another 4 hours worth of stuff to really talk about. I think it took 45 minutes to even get to him working in advertising. But the stories were great. The memories were amazing and impeccable. And he just wants to do something different with it. And I think that's perfect and brilliant. We'll get into that at some point in the future. But because I don't know when that's going to be, I don't want to start talking about it now. But it'll be fantastic. If my hour and a half with him that we'll never hear is anything to go by, then the bits we end up doing will be amazing, and I'm really looking forward to that. Anyway, that's the sort of housekeeping, apologetic, slightly whatever stuff out the way. So now, please enjoy my chat with Danny Kleinman. Normally, I go back through people's careers a little bit just to see how things kind of began. And I was going to ask you how you went from Hornsey Art School to making music videos.
Well, when I was at art school, I didn't have much money, and I had a friend who called Stephen Barron, who worked in Samuelson's camera hire, and I also was in a band at the time, and Steve wanted to be a director, and I kind of was into playing music, being in a band, and he used to borrow the cameras, in inverted commas, at the weekends from Samuelson's camera hire, and he came and he filmed up my band, and then he kind of went off and started filming other bands, and kind of started up doing music videos, and this is in the 70s, so it was really early on. It was before, you know, music videos took off at all, really, and they were only occasionally seen on TV or whatever, no MTV or anything. And he just went from strength to strength, and it became, obviously, it was a greater sort of demand from bands for visual things to promote their songs. And he, you know, went from being a sort of clapper loader to a fully fledged music video director in pretty quick time. And the difference between him and I was that he hadn't had any sort of training at art school, so he had a lot of technical ability with cameras and he'd been on camera crews and knew how to film things really well. But you know, when it was coming up with concepts for music videos, he used to kind of come around and ask me, you know, have you got any ideas or what do you think we could do for this music video? And so I used to kind of think of ideas and draw some storyboards and say, oh, well, you know, if it'd be fun if this happened or that happened. And sometimes he'd bung me a few quid and sometimes he'd do it, you know, I'd do it for a curry. He was doing really well, and I thought sometimes Steve had done the ideas that I'd kind of conceived, but he'd done them in a way which I wouldn't have done them, and I thought, well, then maybe I should have a go at doing it myself. And also, eventually Steve's ideas really took off, and he didn't need me at all to come up with any ideas. He had just had such brilliant ideas of his own and went on to do all sorts of amazing things. But his sister, who was his producer and who had, he was a very old friend of mine, quite fancied one of the blokes, the lead singer in a band that I'd actually written the concept for their video. I didn't direct it, but I'd written the concept and done the storyboards. And she said, I tell you what, I adore it, really.
Interesting. And the music thing's a big background for you. And I wondered if, because although it's not so much connected with you as a director, do you want to tell us a little bit about how, as it says in your Wikipedia, Bazooka Joe, your band, had a varied changing lineup of musicians, notably Adamant, Arabella Weir. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, when I was at school, there was a school band which was called Bazooka Joe. I didn't come up with the name, actually. My friend John Ellis, who was in the band, came up with the idea of that. And we played together as a band. It was basically a school band, but then we started doing sort of some clubs and pubs and things. John then and went on to have loads of bands. He played with the Vibrators, and he went on to be in the Stranglers and played with Peter Gabriel. He's still doing music now. But he left and I kind of carried it on, and lots of people, he carried on into art school, and when I was at art school, Adam, or Stuart as he was then, joined the band, and I had other friends in the band, and then lots of people came in and out of the band. Many people went on to do other groups and other things. The only sort of consistent person that in it who kind of never had any success at all was me. And that's probably because I couldn't sing. but it was a really, it was a great laugh. I mean, I had a fantastic time and played. We did lots of art schools. We did universities, pubs, clubs, and did tours around Britain, did all sorts of things. But it was, this is sort of pre-punk, so it was pretty kind of, now it tends to call pub rock, but it wasn't really pub rock. It was kind of rather aggressive London rock. It's more akin to a band we used to play with a lot called Kilburn and the High Roads, which was Ian Drury's band. And then there was also other bands on the circuit who were doing really great things, like Dr. Feelgood and Eddie and the Hot Rods. And it was kind of it was pre-punk, so it was a lot of energy and whatever, but I had a real laugh. But in the end, I'm sort of pleased that I didn't really become a pop star, because I don't think I would have been much good at it. And also, you know, I like being behind the camera rather than in front of it. Actually,
talking of that and the direction part of it, I'll list a few of the videos you did on my blog so people can check that out. But I was just looking through them myself, and the video for Don't You Forget About Me, you might be interested to know it's had 68 million views on YouTube, but why is it set in a room full of toys?
Well, Don't You Forget About Me is one of the most bizarre stories in music video creating, I should be.
Great.
it was basically, it was a a song to promote a movie.
Yeah.
The Breakfast Club, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was sort of the only song that, that Simple Minds hadn't written themselves. And they weren't very keen on it. They didn't really like the lyrics. And the movie producer or the publicist from the movie studio said, right, okay, we don't really need any of the film in it. We don't need any stuff. What we want is just a really heartfelt story. I wrote this story, which I thought was really great. It fitted with the lyrics, and it was a sort of homecoming story up north. It was very kind of realist, and everyone goes, hey, yeah, that's great. And then someone at the movie studio or promoting the film, just as we were about to start to make it, said, no, I hate it, I don't want to do that, we've got to come up with another idea. Unfortunately, that was on, I think it was like the 21st of December, something like that, so it's Christmas, and it had to be done very quickly in order to get it out for the release of the movie. So I had to think on my feet very quickly, and I had a photo in a book, which was a family outside a house, and piled on the ground in front of them was every single thing that they owned inside the house. And it sort of sparked this idea. I thought, well, what it would be like if you had a big empty room and it just started filling up with every single thing you'd ever owned in your life. You know, how much junk there would be. It would be, you know, you'd sort of suffocate under the piles of your own material stuff that you bought throughout your life. So that was the kind of idea. And it started, we had very little time to get it together. We couldn't find anywhere to film it, and we ended up filming at Nebworth House for some reason, which I think is the only place we could get into over Christmas. And it was all rather kind of ramshackle thing. And that's why it sort of starts with him singing by himself, and then there's toys, and then there's more adult things, and then more adult things, and then it builds up like that. And that was the kind of idea. The flaw in the idea is that nobody apart from me understood it. So, it just became a rather bizarre, enigmatic thing. I think it was a surprise to everybody that the song became quite such a big hit and got seen a lot. I think I did make better music videos, but Sod's Law is that they were all for songs that disappeared and never got seen again, and the one that seemed to have got seen an awful lot is kind of rather bizarre. But I always kind of thought of music videos as my film school, so I felt, even though I'd always try things out and try new experiments, and I never really did the same thing twice. I didn't have a style, I was experimenting and learning how to be a director and learning about visuals and learning about film crews, and in a way, the bands came second to me, and I sort of feel a little bit bad about it in that, perhaps, they were wanting someone who was a bit more kind of emotionally involved in their music. But on the whole, I did stuff for music that was really, really pretty poor. And all I can say is that I helped not inflict that poor music on everybody else, because disappeared into obscurity with my terrible music videos. But I did do some which I think were kind of okay, but every single one I learned something from. So even the ones which were maybe less successful were a learning thing for me. And it's, it was great to be able to kind of, it was a time when you could experiment and you could do things which were a bit out there, and record companies and bands kind of quite liked you doing something wacky and bizarre and unusual, and getting onto MTV, it didn't look like anything else. And that was, so that was the good side of it.
I think one of the songs which is actually a good song and a really good video is Big Love by Fleetwood Mac. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's a very post kind of heavy video. It looks very, how did they do that kind of thing, particularly at that time. So was that one of the more experimental ones that you got into?
It was. It was really, really difficult. I mean, the thing about that one was that it was a time when, you know, now you can do keying, you can do blue screen, you can do all that sort of thing on a laptop. Then it was very, very difficult to get an even key. You had to be in a big studio with an enormous lighting system. Quite often you'd have backlights, so it's like a big bank of fluorescent tubes that were covered in a blue film, which gave a very even blue, and you could then put people in front of it, and then you could key them into a background. But I was trying to do it on location outside with very primitive kind of lighting, primitive blue screen. So, and also I was trying to make a continuous camera move, which, you know, nowadays with motion control and all sorts of things is pretty easy, but I was doing it by timing it out and trying to get the lenses and the timing of the camera moves to work together, plus keying it into a different background and then one thing becoming another. And it was difficult, and there's some bits which, you know, you look back on it now and it looks terribly, terribly clunky, but at the time it was, you know, people were going, oh wow, isn't that interesting. But it also kind of goes to show how one shouldn't really kind of rely on technique to, you know, come up with some sort of idea from music video or whatever it happens to be, because eventually that technique will become more sophisticated and people will look back on it and think, wow, that looks really shit. But I think really the idea is the most important thing. And I think it was a kind of amusing idea as kind of one of these picture in a picture type things. It's very like a Pink Floyd album cover or something, and you go from one thing to another. And I wanted to see if it could be done with film and video within the auspices of the song and the time and the money and whatnot, and it's partially successful. It was it was good, and they were an interesting group to work with. They had terrible problems, each of them. None of them were talking to each other at the time. They all sat in separate Winnebagos. They all had different managers, and Stevie Nicks, whatever her name is, just come out of rehab and was in a very fragile state, and had just also had some plastic surgery on her neck, so she looked really terrible. And the whole thing was kind of pretty bizarre, but whatever came out of it at the end was just one of those 80s things, you know. It's a kind of mad film that is what it is, but you know, if I went back and redid it, I'd probably do it differently, but, you know, it was an experience anyway.
Yeah, as much as I'd love to talk about DeBarge and Prince and Madonna, maybe we should move on to your ads, because I think the interesting thing is, I think when I first knew of you, and when most advertising creators first knew of you, you were the guy who did the funny ads. Like, there wasn't so much post-heavy stuff, but things like Int Milk Brilliant and Boddington's and things like that, they were really funny ads. So were you aiming specifically for that sort of niche, or did that just happen?
No, I've always enjoyed doing things that were comedy. I mean, some of the music videos I did, I tried to make sort of amusing, as well as, I think because of coming from music videos, I tried lots of different genres. As I said, you know, I was using it as my own kind of learning period, at somebody else's expense, luckily, and I just tried lots of different things. And so when it came to sort of starting to do some ads, in fact, the first few ads I did were very post-heavy. They were technical things that other people kind of looked at and thought, oh, that looks a bit difficult, I'm not going to have a go at that. And I just thought, well, I think I know how to do that and I could do it. And I was quite au fait with the latest post equipment, which was all sort of analog ADOs and very kind of what would look like laughably primitive technology today. But I knew how to use them, and I knew how to abuse them as well, how to kind of make something, use a tool to make something happen which wasn't meant to be for, but made an interesting effect. And the first few ads, actually, a couple from America and a couple in England, I think, which probably didn't get seen much, were more post-heavy. But then I did also, at the same time, I had been working quite a lot with other friends who were comedians and doing sort of funny TV stuff. I did a TV series with Rick Mayall, and I did a TV special with Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse, and at the same time I was doing these more sort of technical things, and so I had, you know, I was doing both things at the same time, really, and it just worked out lucky for me, because I didn't really get pigeonholed. I was able to turn my hand to doing something photographic, which was you know, sort of beautiful to look at, or something which was funny, or something which had a lot of post effects. And then sometimes there were ads, like I did some for with Jack D, some beer ads.
No, the John Smith.
John Smith, yeah, those early John Smith ones, which were kind of funny, very post heavy, and meant to look pretty at the same time. So, you know, that then it's quite handy to have you know, a bit of experience in all those areas.
And did you know much about the kind of advertising scene? Because going into music videos and then into commercials is, I mean, a few people have sort of done it, but was it something you would, you know, aiming to do as a next stage in your career, or was it something you kind of fell into a bit more?
It was pretty fell into it. I'd like to say I have a plan for my career, but I don't. I just, you know, move blindly forward doing the next thing, which I find interesting. I just sort of started doing few music videos and started doing more commercials, and partly that was because I just fell out of love with the music. I'd never been particularly interested in most of the songs that I was doing videos to anyway. And then I did a few live concerts. I did one for Prince, and I did one with my other bands. I did one for Van Halen, which is kind of genre of music which I really am not interested in at all. And I spent probably about 3 or 4 weeks editing this interminable concert film, which I'd shot over several nights in different places around America on 24 cameras, and it was a massive thing. And I just had to sit there and edit it and listen to this music non-stop all day for days and days and days. And I eventually thought, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. And I was sort of quite enjoying the shorter projects and more conceptual projects of doing advertising. So it was serendipitous more than anything.
And a lot of those commercials in the early ones seem to have been done with some really, really good creatives. I mean, there was, you know, Richard Flintham and Andy McLeod and people like that. But I think you ended up, in terms of the humour side of things, doing a lot of really good work with Paul Silbern. Did you like click, or did you find you were quite simpatico about how you wanted your work to be together?
Yeah. I mean, we're still good friends. He's a very clever man, a very funny man, and we. I think he was a bit put out because the first script he sent me, I turned down. But he persevered and sent me another one, which I did do, and we worked together, and we seemed to work together really well. And, you know, he has an instinctive understanding of comedy, and he's also just a very nice person. And I'm the sort of director who likes to have a nice environment around me. I don't like being in a kind of fractious atmosphere, so you know, it's nice to make the process be pleasant. And he's a nice bloke to work with, and as I say, very, very clever. So we did quite a few ads together, you know, which were really enjoyable. But, you know, as you say, there were a lot of great creatives around when I, you know, first started to really concentrate on commercials, which was in the night, you know, all the people that went on to start Mother, and just a lot of people who are now all kind of the elderly statesmen of advertising.
I was going to say that a lot of your ads, a lot of your funny ones particularly, were with very famous comedians, you know, whether it was Johnny Vegas or Peter Kay or Paul Whitehouse or whatever it was. But not all of them were. And so I don't know, was there a difference between working with those personalities and making them work for the commercials you were doing, or was that not an issue?
It's not really an issue because, you know, ideally when you kind of work with a sort of talented comedian or talented actor, it should be, you know, an equal playing field with the director and the actor, and you work together. I mean, Peter Kay was an interesting case in point, that when he did the first series of John Smith's commercials, he was very nervous. He hadn't really done any commercials before, and he was actually not particularly well known at the time. And I think it's fair to say that, that those ads kind of heightened his popularity and the awareness of him by an enormous amount, and made him sort of helped him be very successful. I'm not sure he would have been without them, but he it definitely helped. And his attitude on the first set that we did, he was very kind of compliant and, you know, easy, did what I asked. And the second lot, he sort of wised up a bit and threw in a lot of his own opinions. And and actually that was better, because it's better to work with someone rather than just, you know, tell someone what to do and they do it. You know, it's much, much better to feel almost like the director's job is to bring out the comedy in somebody else. It's not to tell them how to do it. It's just to give them the facility to be themselves and do the performance that most makes their own personality and their own humour flow. And that's very true with you know, sort of Martin Freeman or Harry Enfield or Paul Whitehouse or any of those great comedians I've worked with.
Yeah. From my point of view as a creative at that time, there seemed to be, for me, there was a dividing line in the perception of you that happened with Wakeboarder. Because the stuff you'd done before Wakeboarder, maybe I'm generalising a little bit here, was funny. And I'm not saying the stuff afterwards wasn't funny, but you did a lot of cooler stuff afterwards, which is like the Jimi Hendrix Audi stuff, Johnny Walker Fish, things like that, where they weren't so much to laugh at, but they were really cool. I don't know if that, again, was anything deliberate on your part, but it seemed to have been a change that happened with that ad. Were you aware of that?
Not really. I mean, again, I don't really think I had a plan or a deliberate idea to do anything. I mean, I literally take on projects if I read the scripts and I think, wow, I can imagine that. And to me, the idea is everything. If I read it and I think that's a great idea, I've not seen that before, or there's something interesting I can do with that, or, you know, that is funny, or that is very beautiful, or it's, you know, that sounds like the visuals will be amazing, then I'll be into it. It doesn't really matter to me whether it's, you know, comedy or it's action or whether it's dialogue or, you know, animation. I mean, I did an ad for Lux Soap, which was actually, I think it was for South America or something, but it was entirely CG. I had no, he didn't shoot anything at all, and that was sort of quite an interesting thing to do. So it certainly wasn't a something I felt I should do this sort of stuff instead of that sort of stuff. I just would have got the script and gone, wow, that looks good, and I wouldn't mind having a go at that. But it, I think it also comes from, you know, before I started doing commercials, I'd already been directing for over 10 years. So, you know, I had been doing an awful lot of other things and different varied things. The tools of my trade and craft were, you know, already there to be able to be a kind of diverse director rather than a, you know, some directors have a very particular style and you can look at their stuff and you go, I know exactly who did that. And that it's charming and wonderful in a way, and it's the way that directors become famous auteurs, because you know what you're going to get when you go to them. I suppose it's like some actors, you know, you're always going to get pretty much the same performance and the same character regardless of what film they're in or who they're playing. And that, I hope, isn't me to that extent. I like the fact that I'm, you know, I have a broader vision and able to turn my hand to various different things and be subservient to the concept rather than the technique or the style. that as well, which are that you can perhaps not get taken so seriously or whatever, or not be so cool at a certain time. But actually, I think in terms of career-wise, it's better for longevity because you can keep going and keep doing things and whatever. If you only really have one style, then once, as we all know, advertising is a very fashion business, and once everybody's gone, wow, isn't this style interesting? And then the second time they go, yeah, that was great, that style. And then the third time they're going, okay, what's the next style? You know, it has a lifespan, and I've never wanted to be like that. So I think keeping it diverse is good for me.
Can I just ask, for one example, as how something might have come about? When Xbox Champagne came to you, did you know how you were going to be able to do that when the script arrived, or was it an exploration?
It was a total exploration. I see a problem and then I go around solving it. It's not a, and in finding innovative ways to solve it and finding ways one can bring something to life within the budget and within the amount of time you've got. And, there are all sorts of so many variable factors in creating an ad that you have to take into account. I mean, if you have unlimited time and unlimited money, practically you could do anything, but it's always down to how can this idea be best brought to life within the parameters of what I've of the rules I've got or the constrictions I've got, and sometimes that discipline brings out great things and you come up with stuff you would never have thought of, or ways of doing things which are slightly counterintuitive. I mean, one of the things which actually springs to mind, it was the John Smith's Bear ad, where it was very little money. I was one of the first ones I did with Paul Silburn, and at the beginning you go, okay, a bear fights with a fisherman. What is it? A real bear? Is it a CG bear? Is it an animatronic bear? Do you go in and do lots of close-ups? Do you do lots of cuts? Is it very violent? Do you see blood? Is it? Who wins? All that. There are various kind of questions one has to ask because it's not written in the script, and the director's job is to kind of take a stance on it. And literally one of the reasons I decided to film it as a observed nature film, where you never got too close to the action, was to make it feel very close to the suit, because we could only afford a really rubbish bear suit that was off the peg. It wasn't made to fit the stuntman inside it. It was it's a really cheapo suit. So, in a way, that practicality forced the technique on me, but it played into making it good. And so I'm definitely one for embracing the adversity and embracing the problems and turning them to one's advantage. And so in the we were talking about to begin with?
The John West Bear? Champagne, the Xbox.
Oh, the Champagne one, yeah. There was, I mean, weirdly, that was meant to only be a viral ad to begin with, and but everyone liked it so much it went on TV. But, I really had to think about how to make that and approach it in various different ways and did various cheats and things. I mean, you look at it, actually, the technical side of it is pretty scruffy, because it was only ever going to be a viral on the internet in the days when the pictures on the internet were really pretty low quality film. So the keys weren't sort of superb. Some of the effects are a little bit, if I thought it was going to get projected big, I would have, spent more time on them and whatnot. But in the end, it doesn't really matter, because you're looking at the story and the flow of the action and, how the story is told. And it's a sort of macabre gag at the end, and you get it, and it kind of it worked. I think it got pulled. I think somebody complained, but it was on air for a bit anyway.
So if you don't have an enormous amount more time, there's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, which was is the James Bond titles, because they have a certain consistent sort of element to them and sort of vibe and things like that. How do they differ conceptually, and what's that process like?
Well, the Bond titles are a kind of interesting thing that I do just for pure love. I mean, it's such a so much fun to do. I mean, they're hard work and quite stressful in many ways, but also it's just so fantastic to work on something so iconic. And you know, luckily enough, since, well, for over 20 years, I've been, you know, asked every few years to jump in and do them. And it's kind of why I've never really gone back to doing music videos, because I get to do this, what is, I kind of see as the world's greatest music video every couple of years, yeah, or something anyway, you know. I can pretty much do what I like. It's presented on the big screen. It's you know, it's a massive iconic thing that I remember from my childhood. And the trick with it is the balance I have to get is to try and create something that is feels new and feels fresh, but also is very rooted in the traditions of the past and has pays homage to all the language of the Bond titles that were sort of invented by Maurice Binder in the 60s. You just can't throw that heritage out of the window. One has to celebrate it and reinvent it and reinterpret it and try and keep that something special that makes a Bond film a Bond film and not just another action film. That's a great challenge, and I really enjoy doing it, actually.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just kind of this marriage of the song is always a big song, because that's a Bond thing, and then the movie may have a certain slightly different kind of vibe to it. Like, Spectre's titles are very different to, well, I mean, they're all different to each other, but Spectre gets a lot sort of sexier with the kind of octopus kind of things wrapping around stuff and whatever. But,
yeah.
And then...
odd love.
Yeah, it is. It's almost like part some of the things that were in the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. There was sort of elements. It's Daniel Craig getting involved in dark, sexy, scary things in a good way. And the women part of it. Can I just ask? Is there like we're going to have this many minutes or seconds of like silhouetted sexy women floating around, or?
No, not at all. No, it's all down to 90% of that is down to my taste, and 10% is down to whether the director of the main film kind of might have a say. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to big myself up, because the director of the main part of the film really is the one who should have the final say over everything. But the thing is, when I'm doing the titles, they're off doing the main film and haven't got time to deal with the titles. So a lot of the directors have just set me off as an autonomous unit, and I do what I think. So Sam Mendes is a little bit different. He got a bit more hands-on. And I think in Skyfall, there were a couple of scenes with girls in that he thought was too many, and I said, fine, I took them out. In Casino Royale, Mr. Campbell, the director, said he didn't want any girls in it at all, and there aren't any. And I totally agreed with that, actually. And that was a very good call by him, because it was the story of that movie. It was about James Bond before he comes James Bond, and it's before his life and his treacherous first love have betrayed him, and he's not quite the misogynist sort of lady killer that he becomes. So it was sort of inappropriate that title sequence for that. But you know, I think originally Maurice Binder used the women in it as a kind of symbol of sexiness, and saying, you know, because Bond was written as a womanizer by Ian Fleming,
yeah.
And he was not, you know, particularly nice to women, but as time has gone on, obviously Bond has changed and become a Bond for our time, and he now is, you know, sympathetic to women. He's probably a women's libero, for all I know. I have no idea. But he actually, then, you can't just have kind of sort of winsome ladies with no clothes on doing sort of pointless erotic dances around. You know, I've whenever I put the ladies into the sequence, they've always kind of been there for a reason. They're not just gratuitous. They kind of represent something. Or like, for instance, in Skyfall, it sort of opens with a woman's hand kind of dragging Bond under the water, and a lot of the malevolent kind of images are female images with him. So the figures are sexy, but they're also slightly threatening at the same time. And that's because in the movie, he's betrayed by his girlfriend. M betrays him and tells Moneypenny to shoot him. Moneypenny, who's a woman, shoots him, and he's left for dead. So he's actually, you know, pretty hard done by women in the film. And it, so in a sense, I was sort of trying to symbolize that, and not just have them there just for titillation. It's a kind of more metaphoric in my mind, anyway.
Cool. Well, I know you're enormously busy, so that's I'm hugely grateful for the time you've spared.
Not at all, Ben. Do you want to talk more? What's the time now?
It's 9:30 for me, so 5:30 for you.
5:30. I can give you another 15 minutes if you want.
Okay.
Have you petered out of questions?
No, I haven't. I skimmed through things faster than I would otherwise have done, because I just wanted to make sure we got an overall thing of your career rather than noodle around on something like, say, Noit You Love. Because, again, when you get a script like Noit You Love, I guess there's a lot of questions there as to which parts of the history of the entire planet you're going to put in. And how was that? And how was the collaboration with Matt and Ian on that?
That was an interesting ad. No, it was a great project. I mean, it was one of my perfect sort of scripts, because it's a really big vision, but written in about three sentences. You know, there's no... Matt and Ian hadn't written it in great detail. It was a very, very kind of simple idea, basically time going backwards, and the famous Guinness weight being millions of years for a good drink, and but run backwards so that you get the gag at the end, and then what the images are, or what the pictures were, or the sequence of events and what's in it was down to me to come up with. And you know, it's sort of such a great place to be, to have a big blank sheet of paper and come up with ideas. And the first thing I thought was, I just wanted to throw the reality of evolution out of the window. You know, because it's not a school film. It's not a lesson in what actually really happened. It's far more fun that a caveman turns into a monkey, that turns into a bird, that turns into a fish, and you know, all that, those historical kind of evolution and what our prehistory is so vague anyway that, you know, I don't think anybody really knows. And so I don't care about being accurate. I just want it to be amusing. And so it was a lot of, you know, obviously then I had to discuss it with the creatives and then try and talk the poor clients through it, who were, you know, couldn't really kind of understand any of it, because this isn't something you can just film. You can't go out and find a scene and turn the camera on and film it. This is entirely constructed out of nothing. It's bits and pieces of all sorts of things that are collaged together to give the effect of time passing backwards. So there's bits of CG, there's bits of films of people in prosthetic makeup. There's I had a whole load of sort of flowers which we flew, put blow torches on to make them wilt so that I could run them backwards, and lots. like that. Right. You can't, you know, it's just made up. It's like a collage. It's like taking Kurt Schwitters or some constructivist painting. It's just all bits and pieces all thrown together to make an impression, a collage. And my new shy of, you know, if someone's walking backwards and they're kind of a Neanderthal-looking person, you know, what would their gait be? And so I got a lady who works with apes and chimpanzees to come and work with the actors so that they could get the proper body language for being a sort of Neanderthal. But then also because I wanted them to look like they were being dragged back into the past, I tied sort of weights, I think it was tires, behind them, so that when they walked, they had to really lean forward, so that when I ran it backwards, and they were running back, walking backwards, it really looked like they were kind of struggling and being sucked back into the past. And there's just all, you know, little touches like that that make it sort of a fun thing to create. The big problem, though, from, you know, a sort of client advertising point of view, is that you then got an edit. Your first edit has literally got nothing in it. It's sort of, you know, a picture of a monkey and a sort of bit of stock footage of a bird flying about, and then a wireframe CG animal. And they're going, "What the hell is this?" I'm thinking, "No, honestly, it'll be great. It's going to be great." The one funny thing we did on that one actually was at the end, there's these kind of mud skippers, which were real. And we filmed them on a little muddy set, and they flipped and flopped about and had to do a little drinking in this muddy pool. And, you know, we got them specially flown in from Indonesia, and it took ages to get them. I had to go through customs and had to be a vet on the set and a special animal wrangler who was the middleman for getting them from abroad and getting them there. And it was a whole big deal, cost tons of money, and filmed them. They actually worked. In fact, actually a couple had died en route, but you know, we had enough left to make it work. And then the next week I went with my nephew to a pet shop in Camden Town, and they sold them in the pet shop. I couldn't believe it, but you know, that was an interesting project. It seems like there aren't so many of those kind of big vision bravura type ads made these days. I'm sure they may come back. One hopes they will. You know, so the history, if you look back on them, they're from that sort of big spectacle. It used to be Tony Kaye doing it, or
Jonathan like Glazer. You know,
where you get these sort of Jonathan Glazer or
Frank Badgen. Yeah,
great. Frank. Yeah. Yeah. Lovely big sit back, wow, this is amazing type things. But and you know, it's nice that I've got to do a few of those type of things with that sort of breadth of scale, but the fewer and further between these days.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation, I think, with Johnny Frankel around that kind of time, because it won the Cannes Grand Prix, and I think there had been some sort of expectation that Champagne might have been up for possibly winning that a few years earlier, and then it won. Are you aware of awards in that way? Do they matter to you?
What I say about awards is that it's nice to get them. It's nice to get an award and get a pat on the back, but then you just can't take it too seriously, because, you know, when you don't get it for something you really enjoyed or think is worthy, then, you know, you can't get too angry. If you don't get too pleased and you don't get too angry, you've probably got about the right attitude to it. But I've won a lot of awards. I'm very lucky to have, well, I'm not lucky, I've bloody worked hard for
it. Exactly.
And, you know, I've got awards. But, you know, do they matter in the end? No. I mean, weirdly, you know, it was nice. I think my mum was alive long enough to see me get a few awards. It probably meant more to her than it did to me. But it's nice that your peers think you're doing a good job, and it's nice to have a pat on the back. But I don't go to them really anymore. I can't be asked. I'd rather watch TV and drink a glass of wine.
Makes sense. I did another podcast episode with Neil Dawson, and he quite rightly is very, very proud of the Johnny Walker Fish ad. And you created rigs for that to get the people to jump out of the water and stuff. Again, what was the script and what was going through your mind when you got it?
That was one of the most difficult ads I've ever directed. I mean, that was hard, really difficult. You know, it was not anything that had been done before. We had to think on our feet. It was also, you know, before digital CG was really good enough to kind of take over for human bodies, and I wanted to do the stuff in camera as much as possible. So we were out in on a raft boat, a big tug with a raft lashed to it, out in the open sea with a Lumar crane on this raft with, you know, sort of practical effects for the stuntmen and the camera crew, and you know, the water's bashing up and down and the crane's flying around, and we've got people in the water with security people with, you know, shark repellent sticks in the water, and these sort of a lot of stunt people who are rigged to a special rig which kind of yanked them out of the water. They also had we developed this, which was a rather clever idea, I must say, even though I'm saying it myself, was to have one of those fishtail flippers that freedivers use. It's like a single flipper. But I'd seen a science program where there's a type of plastic which has the same refractive index as water. So when you put it into water, you can't see it. And so these actors, these stunt people, had these flippers, but once they're underwater, you literally can't, they disappear. And then we'd be scurrying along at fucking how many knots, don't know, and then they they give an underwater signal, fly up towards the surface of the water as fast as they could, and then the people who were, they were connected by wires to a pulley system to people on this raft, and they'd yank these ropes as hard as possible and pull them out of the water so that they'd fly out of the water like dolphins. And it was pretty spectacular. And actually, at the end of it, the stunt people were all saying, you know what, you should make that into a sport. People would pay to do that. But it was pretty hairy. All sorts of things happened. It was so rough. And I remember hearing on my headphones, so we had underwater mics, so I could hear what was going on with the underwater cameramen and stuff. And at one point, I heard this thing going, people screaming, going, And I thought, what the hell's going on? You know, somebody caught in a rudder or whatever. But what had happened is there'd been a current that had taken all these electric shock sticks, which keep the sharks away, and they swept them into the security men, who were all getting electrocuted by their own shark equipment. I mean, you know, you can't write it. It was brilliant, but that was a challenge. I mean, it was a challenge not only from production, but just behind the scenes, it was a challenge just getting insurance to do this sort of thing. You know, months. It was really tricky.
The other one I wanted to ask about was the Jimi Hendrix Audi ad, partly because, again, from the outside, it doesn't look like there's much of a script beyond, you know, Audi designers listen to this Jimi Hendrix song when they invent the car. So was it that loose, and did you have a huge amount of space, and did you feel a responsibility to convey Jimi Hendrix's sort of influence on that in a way that was consistent with him as a musician?
Yeah, all those things. I mean, it was another one of those really nice scripts where the idea was that it was based on something which apparently was true, that they had been playing this track while they'd been designing the car, and the point was to go into some kind of Hendrix surreal kind of pseudo psychedelic world of, you know, bizarreness and beauty and how you get inspired to be creative. And I kind of worked with Sean Broughton, who was at Smoke and Mirrors in London at the time, and came up with, you know, all these slightly wacky images, but pretty much we were sort of making it up on the fly a bit. You know, I had key sort of ideas. I like the idea of the record player becoming all these swirling circular motifs, which are very Audi, and using them also like planets, and the circular thing becoming like the solar system, and they're all getting a bit spacey, and you know, it was just, you know, one sort of image flies into another and produces just thoughts. And I suppose from art school days, you just you know, brainstorm it and run with it and try different things. I mean, I think there are some sequences in it which work better than others, but in terms of it looking kind of like modern psychedelia, which was the idea, it kind of had its moments.
And the other thing I was going to ask you about was setting up Rattling Stick, because I think you went through what Spectre and Large and then Rattling Stick. Was there a relationship you had with, say, Ringen or Ringen and Johnny, or is there a vision you've got for that company?
You know, once again, it's me kind of just sort of not having a plan, but just following whatever opportunities and things turn up. I mean, originally I was with a company called Limelight, which, sort of mentioned right at the beginning, which was Steve Barron's company, and I was just a working director at that company. But he got fed up with it. He went off to do, he wasn't really into ads, he wanted to do movies, and he went off and did that and said, look, why don't you just take it over? And I thought, okay, well, I will. And at the time, it was kind of running. It used to be very big in it. But Bertie also got slightly disenchanted with advertising, you know, or the way it was then, and he decided to leave. And we thought we'd amalgamate with Jeff Stark's company, because then we'd have the kind of award-winning Spectre and the larger Jeff Stark's company, which was turning over a lot of money, so to have the kind of financial security of that and be able to carry on doing the more kind of exciting work. But unfortunately, there was a bit of a dip in the market. It didn't really work because a lot of the directors who were signed at Stark then stopped getting any work at all, and it was sort of Large by name and Large by nature, and it really just started losing money straight away. At which point, Jeff and I just thought, no, you know, this doesn't work as a model, and we closed the company. Everyone got paid. It wasn't there was no controversy there. It was too unwieldy. There were too many people. You know, there were sort of three CEOs. There was a librarian. There was a this. There was a that. It was like a really big company without the kind of engine to run it. And that was, you know, partly down to me not being a businessman or not understanding the dynamics of that. So then I kind of went totally the opposite direction. And by then, Johnny Frankel was my producer, and he and I started Kleinman Productions, which was just me and him in an office. And that really was for several years, and it was probably one of the most brilliant and successful times I'd had. I certainly made more money just being by myself than being in a company. And, you know, I could do what I liked, did everything. It was really great. But I was kind of aware then that I had responsibilities to Johnny and a PA and a secretary and various people, that if I didn't work, I wanted to take 6 months off or go and do a movie or do something else, then everybody would be sort of out of work and twiddling their thumbs. So we decided, okay, it needs to get a bit bigger. And we took on a couple of directors, and at the same time, Ringen, who I knew vaguely but not well, had just come off a movie, and he'd gone through exactly the same thing. He had a small company called a small family business that, while he was doing the movie, it had kind of just stopped because he was the main person there, and he realized that model didn't work either. So we kind of got together and talked about it and decided to amalgamate. And he said, we had the office space then and everything, so he said he'd come and join Kleinman Productions. But the only sticking point for him was he didn't like the name, which I thought was very unreasonable. So I said, okay, you don't like Kleinman Productions, why don't we amalgamate our names and we can call it Ring Danny? he didn't like that either, for some reason. I don't know, we just came up with a Rattling Stick. It was just a silly quote from George Orwell about advertising being the rattling stick in a swirl.
Yeah.
And it sort of stuck. And we sort of got on from there, really. It's really great. He's such a talent, Ring, and he's such a nice person. Johnny's still running the company. It's full of, our ethos is to only have nice people that we get on with, and it's really great. There's very creative directors here, and we've opened up in the States, and it's going well there. And it's an absolute pleasure. Finally, got to a point where it's all running like clockwork. So, with any luck, I can spend a few more hours in the garden.
Perfect.
Digging the vegetables.
Absolutely. Well, that is, I think, everything I wanted to ask, other than why Steve Guttenberg isn't in the video for Who's Johnny. But let's not get into that. Let's not get into that. That's fine. That's no problem.
Oh, God, don't mention that video.
Don't mention that. So, yeah, that's fantastic. There's loads of really amazing stuff in there, Danny. Thanks so much for your time.
I remember you, didn't you, when you were an Ant fan, weren't you?
I was in what?
You were an Ant fan, weren't you?
Yeah. You before the decent days of Photoshop, you stuck my... Because I told you I wrote to Jim Will Fix It. I mean, this is all a bit weird now. And you sent me a photo of me drumming with Adam and the Ants, but really quite badly put together in a very charming way.
On Jim Will Fix It?
There's a photo you have found of Adam and the Ants, and you replaced whoever, whether it's Marco or whoever does the drumming, with my head with a sort of sombrero on it. I don't know if that was something that we did in New Orleans, but...
But that was... Yeah, I remember doing that now, but that was a picture of Jim Will Fix It, because that's when I was in Adam and the Ants, and we did Jim Will Fix It.
Oh, my God. Oh, right, now I get it. Oh, okay, well, that's...
I can't remember exactly the framing of the picture, but if there's a sort of moody-looking bloke in black, that would be me.
Yeah, I think that was it. I'm going to have to dig that out of my files now. But that was...
I remember that now. I remember the photo of you in a sombrero. Where did that come from? You're not allowed to wear a sombrero anymore. It's it's a sort of insulting to another culture or something. It's kind of very un-PC.
And I'm quite glad I didn't get to go on Jim Will Fix It, because now that we know about Jim, I think I probably had a bit of a swerve there of a terrible situation.
Yeah, I mean, actually, do you remember the when the whole thing about Jimmy Savile came out and whatever, there was that thing on Irish radio where this poor Irish lady announcer who'd been done a talk show, Irish radio talk show, talking show, came on and said, "I'm terribly sorry about an item earlier on where I talked to a man who said that he didn't know what the problem was. He loved Jimmy Savile because he'd fixed it to him to milk a cow with a blindfold on."
Those are the days. Yeah, and thanks so much for the ad we made. That was a lot of fun, and thanks for all the other great ads.
In New Orleans, that was a great trip. That was so good.
Yeah.
And it was, it wasn't a bad ad either. I don't know. It was a fucking weird client, though, but it was...
We can have another conversation about that off the record, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I'll let you get back to your day, and thanks very much.
Not at all. Cheers, Danny. Cheers, mate.
Bye.
Bye.
This is a podcast to watch Christmas.